Graham, the host of Admission Straight Talk. I'd like to start this episode by reading to you an email I received over the summer. Hi, Linda. I wanted to update you on my business school plans. I was just accepted to Northwestern off the wait list, and I will be going to Kellogg in the fall. I am so excited about Kellogg, and I'm so thrilled to have this opportunity. I wanted you to know that there is no way I could have accomplished this without Natalie's help. She has been a source of constant guidance and encouragement for me throughout this process. Natalie has believed in me and my potential from the beginning, and she's been incredibly patient with me. When I started this process, I was essentially clueless, and with Natalie's help, I have gained so much knowledge, not only about business, but also about myself. I am so proud of how much I have grown in the past year, and I know Natalie has played a huge role in my development. I think Accepted is incredibly fortunate to have Natalie on its staff. There is no doubt how much insight Natalie has into the admissions process. But what has impressed me most is what a wonderful person she is. I look forward to keeping in contact with Natalie throughout my time at Kellogg. And again, it has been a pleasure working with her. Best regards. Natalie Greenblatt Epstein, the subject of that email, an MBA admissions consultant extraordinaire, will be our guest today. And I don't think the author of that email exaggerated one iota. But before I dive into the heart of the podcast, which will be all about MBA admissions, I want to tell you about a free resource that you can download from Accepted that will boost your MBA admissions IQ and the quality of your MBA applications. That resource is MBA Admissions A to Z, 26 Terrific Tips. And these tips go from A, for aspirations, to Z, don't put the ADCOM to sleep. This instantly downloadable guide is chock full of great advice on the MBA application process. I'll include a link in the show notes at info.accepted.com/44. I partially introduced Natalie with an email from a client that I quoted from earlier, but let me tell you a little bit more. Natalie earned her MBA at the Michigan Ross School of Business, before it was Ross, and went on to become the Director of MBA Student Affairs and Enrollment Management at Michigan, at Michigan Ross, at the business school there. In 1998, she became the Director of Admissions and Financial Aid at the Johnson School of Cornell University, which is where she and I met for the first time. In 2005, she became the Assistant Dean for Arizona State's Carey School of Management. In 2008, she joined Accepted, where she's become a valued friend, both to me, and a tremendous asset and friend to anyone lucky enough to work with her. As the email I started with evidences, you can see that from there. Her clients have been accepted to Harvard, Wharton, Stanford, Chicago, Kellogg, and most, if not all, the other top MBA programs, along with several other types of graduate programs. The last point I would like to make before welcoming Natalie is that the rave email I read to start is a common email from Natalie's clients. If you don't believe me, please check out Natalie's client feedback page. And again, we'll throw a link to it in the show notes. Enough from me. Let's hear from Natalie. Natalie, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Oh, thank you, Linda. That just made me feel so good.
Good.
I have a little update on that email, too, because I know exactly who that came from. And I just talked to her last week.
Yeah.
I'm not mentioning it.
Okay.
But she wound up getting an investment banking internship, and this is a person who had no business experience before going to business school. So what a long shot for an MD to actually personally call her and invite her to become a summer associate with their bank. And I'm just incredibly proud of that client, and most of the clients that I work with are just spectacular, and you know, I really enjoy working with each and every client that we have at Accepted.
That's great. That's great. And it shows. It shows in the results. Now, I'd like to ask you, how did you get into MBA admissions initially, way back when?
Way back when.
Way back when. I wasn't going to mention how many years. I mean,
they can do the math, but it's a great question, because I had attended Ross for my MBA with the intention of going into brand management. And I actually worked for an advertising agency before, for my summer internship, and had several offers. But I wound up doing a research paper on marketing business schools. And this is before all of the rankings came out, before
really?
you know, yeah, before John Byrne was writing in Business Week and before there was a U.S. News ranking, and nobody was really marketing their programs. Now it's part of what an admissions director must do. But, you know, students just came to programs and nobody really thought about how to position a business school or market a business school. So I took what I perceived to be the top 10 programs and did, you know, basically a competitive analysis and how Michigan could position itself and market to the constituency out there. And the other aspect of this is that I was very active in student government. So the research paper, student government, I got to know the admission staff quite well. Judith Goodman was my supervisor at the time. She was the assistant dean. She's actually a neighbor and a very good friend of mine to this day. And it was all of those things that put together that drew me into admissions. I hadn't intended to stay very long.
You mean you didn't say when you were 6 years old, I want to be an admissions director when I grow up?
I did not. No, no. I wanted to sell toilet paper, actually. So the professor that I did the research paper for had convinced me that, you know, I had this opportunity to make a huge impact on the school, and I wound up staying 11 years making an impact. My legacy still exists in a lot of the initiatives that they continue to use to this day. I was talking
for
to
example?
A client back this morning. Go Blue Rendezvous was my baby. And
really?
Yeah, and the entire interviewing program. We did not interview when I was applying to school. So I developed the interviewing program. I developed the women's initiative at Michigan. And so I really feel like I left a legacy there that continues to this day, and it makes me feel really proud.
I'm sure you have reason to be. You have reason to be. Now, when you were an admissions director, either at Ross or at Cornell, or Arizona State, what is the one thing you really wished applicants would understand that they just didn't get? And if you have more than one, that's okay, too.
I want more than one.
Can
I give you three?
Perfect. You got it.
Okay.
You got it.
All right. So I think the key thing is we're an educational institution, first and foremost. So students didn't understand that they needed to convince me that they could succeed in the program academically. Not every student, but many students. Didn't see us as an academic institution. But business schools exist because there are students and there are faculty, and our mission is education. The second thing was about career services, which most people see business schools as, and 99% of the students applying to the program had no idea what they wanted to do. So, and this is what I do as a consultant now, too, is help people establish their goals. Even if they don't know what they want to do, they often know, or even if they don't know what they want to do, they often know what they don't want to do, but they don't exactly know what they do want to do. At least most of my clients don't. I knew that of candidates who are applying to school. So one of the things they needed to do was convince me that their goals were attainable given their skill set. And if they could convince me of their goals, then they had little problem convincing our recruiters or our alumni of the same.
Right.
And finally, I think, the business school community is really small and people talk. I don't think candidates understand or understood that admissions directors travel together, we talk together. We don't talk about specific candidates, but we certainly talk about the issues that we face. So when you see trends, I know we've had a lot of discussions about the video essays and about the shortened essays this year. Well, a lot of that comes from having dinner together with each other and talking about these issues. And aggregated, you can kind of figure out who's applying to which programs. So we don't, again, not necessarily talking about individual candidates, but making an idea of who is applying to certain schools. And moreover, this small community, students and alumni are incredibly loyal to their school. So if a candidate suggests to a friend or colleague that their first choice is another school, the AdCom will likely hear about it and take appropriate action. So I'd say there's kind of three things that they didn't know. The academic aspect, what to do about goals, and this small network of admissions directors and the business school community itself.
Right. Makes sense. I think in our, and of course the world is even more connected today than it was 20 years ago. I think it's shrunk, and there's all this talk today about personal brand, and it's another word for reputation, and your personal brand, your reputation is what you do and say. So if you're talking to somebody and you say something that may not reflect that well on your interest in a given school, it may somehow get back to somebody you don't want to know about it.
It does. And I mean, there's admissions directors who, will go on chat sites and look at what people are saying. And, they're there publicly to give advice, but they can also sometimes, based on what people say, figure out who those individuals are and kind of figure out what they're up to, particularly a small program. I mean, I did that quite a bit when I was at Cornell, and I had a student team that would help me not try to figure out who everybody was on the chat lines, but figure out what the trends were and answer questions. And the community is small, and it is getting smaller. So you're absolutely right.
Right. Now, you mentioned the shorter word limits a couple of minutes ago. Yeah. How do you advise your clients, to deal with these shorter word limits? Obviously, when you were admissions director, I think you tended to have longer essays in general among most programs. But today, 250 words is normal. So many, many essays are you're talking many times in terms of character limits. What are your suggestions for your clients?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Linda. So I have to say, I was probably part of the trend, but it wasn't quite this extreme. When I started at Michigan, we had 500-600-word essays when I was applying to school. And in fact, HBS, I didn't apply to HBS because they had 600-700-word essays.
And I think they had six essays then.
I thought it was 10, but you might be right.
By the mid-90s, it was...
When you and I were applying, it was a completely different ball game.
True.
So I actually looked at Michigan's process, and I thought we were actually wasting time operationally reviewing essays where people could say the same thing much more succinctly. And so I cut our essays down to 300-400-word essays, which people thought at that time were absolutely impossible to answer. And so I am a proponent of less is more, but as a consultant, I do find 100 words or, for that matter, 100 characters essays a bit extreme.
Right.
But having said that, a lot of applicants try to cram as much information as they can into an essay, and that's really not the purpose of the essay. Or an interview or a conversation that they're having.
What is the purpose?
I think they need to look at this strategically and figure out the key points that they want to communicate about themselves. So so the business schools are actually forcing them to do this with, again, I think 100 character limits are pretty extreme, but we've been able to do that, to say, this is who I am very succinctly. Figure out what the essay is actually asking rather than going off into tangents, because again, everybody wants to cram everything into the application, and that's not what an application is for. An application is what you said before. It's to brand yourself, to really strategically look at yourself and say, okay, this is my brand, this is my elevator pitch, this is, my skill set, this is where I came from, and this is where I'm going. And I think you can do that very succinctly, without going into tangents, answer the essay and answer it with style. And Linda, style points definitely count. When somebody can do it with style, it makes a huge difference. And I think that's one of the things we do really well at Accepted, is put that extra cherry on the sundae.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I know that the, you know, D. Leopold in particular has argued that the application process should not be an essay writing contest. But it's going to be some kind of contest, because there's too few spots for too many people. So going to be a contest in terms of how you present yourself, either through essays, through the boxes of the application, or through the interview or your resume, or it'll be a GMAT contest, a GPA contest. Mm-hmm. But if there's going to be some winners and losers in this particular process, because there are too many people chasing too few seats.
Right. And there's no great formula out there either, as we've seen with rankings of schools. There's no perfect formula out there. And I know that people have tried to create formulas. I mean, when I was at Cornell, there was a faculty member who, you know, gave me an algorithm and said I should use this algorithm and this will enable me to pick the perfect class. But that algorithm was flawed, mm-hmm. because it only took into account academics. It didn't take into account what companies wanted to see in individuals. It didn't take into account what value somebody would add to the program. And you know this from conversations we've had. I mean, I took chances on a lot of candidates because I saw tremendous potential in them. So I, you know, dipped as low as a 2.2 GPA.
Yeah.
At some of the schools that I was at, but those individuals turned out to have graduated with honors, to be, you know, presidents of their class, presidents of their companies, work for, you know, some of the top firms and really rise to the top. I mean,
well, obviously
there are times when those situations happen that an algorithm cannot catch.
Right. And also getting back to your 3 points that you opened with, those people had to somehow show that they did have the academic ability, that GPA was not really representative of what they could do. They had to, you know, to explain it in some way, provide context for it, and then provide evidence that they could do it. They also had to convince you that there is something in them that is going to make them into a leader and a star and somebody that the school will ultimately be very, very proud to have in their community, in its community. So
yeah, absolutely. And that's
also
where, you know, essays and interviews can lend additional tools to, you know, the numbers that someone presents.
Right. I mean,
there is something more. It is an art, it's not a science. Admissions is definitely an art.
Now, we touched on interviews, and you mentioned the importance, and I think this is 100% correct, of approaching the essays strategically and deciding really what is it important that the admissions committee knows that is not provided elsewhere in the application. And that, of course, is what Harvard is asking in its optional question this year. But I also want to, and let's turn now a little bit to the interviews. What's your favorite piece of advice for applicants preparing for a blind MBA admissions interview? And let's face it, most schools do have blind interviews.
Right. So having spent the morning prepping several of my round two candidates for their interviews, I think.
Tis the season.
Yeah. So two really key things. A, you know, I'm a huge proponent of frameworks.
Yes.
So using frameworks to use to create your story helps you, again, stay on point and engage the interviewer in helping them see your the point you're trying to make through your eyes. And then the other thing is practice in front of a mirror, practice, you know, with friends, practice with us. That's, again, what I spent the entire morning doing.
Right.
But I just, you can over rehearse. So you don't want to over rehearse, and you certainly don't want to, you know, read your answers. But I think, you know, putting your stories down on paper and having several different examples.
Examples of what?
Of, you know, whatever your story is going to be. So if they, in a blind interview, they're typically going to ask you to give an example of leadership, to give an example of team skills. You need multiple stories behind those, because they might ask you for, you know, tell me about a time when you were on a team that was dysfunctional. Well, tell me about a time when you were on a team that was functional. And last night I was working with a client who really only had one leadership story to tell, and we had to really dig through her her background to find additional leadership stories that she could use and put them into the framework. So now she has an arsenal, a toolkit, to use for her interview. But you need to be very introspective, and you need to be able to figure out what to do. So the frameworks are keys to that.
Do you have different suggestions for people facing non-blind interviews, like those at Harvard Business School or MIT Sloan?
Yeah, I do. I mean, so interviewers that have read the application tend to dig more deeply into a specific subject matter
right. In
the application. So something that the admissions committee really wants to know about. So again, the introspection is even more important for these non-blind interviews. And a candidate really needs to understand not just the what's, but the why's and the how's behind his or her actions.
Right.
So blind interviews tend to be a little bit more surface. Let me get to know you. Let me see if I want to, you know, have dinner with you rather than just coffee. And a non-blind interview, they're just going to dig deeply into one area where the admissions committee may have some questions. So one of the things you have to figure out is, you know, what do I really need to communicate, or what didn't I communicate in my application that they might want to dig a little bit more deeply into. So it does require a lot more introspection than a blind interview. But regardless, the candidate should still use frameworks and know his or her application and have multiple examples for each question that may be asked.
Right. I think the other thing, they have to prepare additional examples. The person going into a blind interview can reuse some of the examples given in the essays, because the interviewer won't have read the essays.
Right.
The person going into an informed interview, like those at Harvard and MIT, they have to, in addition to being prepared to address gaps or possible questions from the admissions committee, they have to have additional examples of leadership or teamwork or whatever it is that they're likely to be asked about.
Right.
Now, you've spearheaded mock Wharton team-based discussions. What do you think students invited to a TBD should aim to achieve in the team TBD, and how is the TBD different from a conventional interview, blind or otherwise?
When Wharton took this action, I thought this is really interesting, because it really shows a slice of an MBA case experience as opposed to a get-to-know-you experience, which I think, you know, a traditional MBA interview is a get-to-know-you experience, typically, you know, one-on-one. There's some schools that do two-on-one. But, you know, this gives an idea of how you're going to interact in the classroom. So while each candidate needs to present his or her idea for the case that Wharton offers to the candidates that they're having go through the TBD, I think the best strategy for the TBD is to make certain that the discussion moves along, because that's what happens in a case classroom. You want the discussion to move along. The team needs to come up with an optimal solution that's, you know, group thing. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're compromising. That means that you might adopt one person's idea and add on to it. I think one of the frameworks that I would use and that I do use for the Wharton TBD mock interviews is Professor Noel Tishy's GRIP framework, and it works great for the scenario. So it helps the team set the stage. You need to, GRIP stands for goals, roles, information, and process. And what you need to do before going into the TBD is, you know, get to know the other people that are in the TBD. I think that's, you know, don't shy away from it. I like the fact that people are working with us together that might be in the same TBD because they can support each other. But when you, if you don't know everybody ahead of time, you can certainly make certain that everybody understands the objective that you are trying to achieve and the amount of time in which you have to achieve it. Figure out everybody's roles in the beginning. Do you have a facilitator? Do you have a timekeeper? Is there an expert? And does somebody have a better idea than somebody else? And if that's the case, then that person becomes the expert. And how will you communicate this information? Are you, you know, going to go through each of the five individuals and make sure that they have more time to relate their idea? Or is there, you know, are you going to take a vote? How are you going to go through this process? And with the process, you know, how will you use the process to achieve the goals? So again, GRIP, goals, roles, information, process, something I learned at Ross that I value and use in most team situations. It's how I led my teams when I was managing admissions offices. So while Wharton doesn't require it, the teams with whom I've worked on it accepted and know how to nail the process. They can present their idea at the end. Wharton doesn't require you to present the idea at the end, but because they've got the process down, they're able to do that. And I know I heard something like in 20% of the cases, people are actually getting to present their idea for the end of the case at the end. And that's what really happens in a case classroom. You actually present the idea. So I believe if the presentation is done well, again, icing on the cake, but technically what they're doing is observing how well you interact with the team, not whether or not you present the best idea. And then they have the post mini interview, and they want to know honestly what your observations were of the team. And you have to be honest. I mean, if you just say, oh, it went great and it was really dysfunctional, you're not going to get points for that. So did you understand if the team was functional or non-functional? I think that's really key. So knowing what actually happened, making those observations and communicating that in your mini interview is something that they're going to want to know.
Without bashing the other parties.
Without bashing, absolutely. By, you know, just, you know, talking about this in general terms about the team, not about individuals on the team, okay? And, you know, we'll be offering these sessions on February 17th and 25th, so, and I know that every client that participated in these sessions last year and this year has indicated that they've really helped.
Right.
So if, you know, there are more clients that have Wharton interviews, then come join us. The more clients we have, the better it is for you, because it really stimulates what's happening in the Wharton experience.
Right. Do you have any advice for MBA applicants applying now that is specific to later round applications?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly reasons that schools offer later rounds. They actually have space in their class, and despite the fact that, you know, most people want to apply in earlier rounds, my suggestion is, you know, go for it. There's space in the class. That's why these rounds are offered. Some schools will look at these rounds simultaneously with their wait list. And while it may be a little bit more difficult to get into a program later on in the game, it is definitely possible. And embarrassingly, I will admit that I applied in the final round at Michigan. And I will tell you that my friend Derek Bolton also did it, Stanford's assistant dean. So, you know, I wish I had applied earlier. I wouldn't have felt as rushed as I did when I was weighing my possibilities. I mean, Derek and I have often talked about that, looking back on our own experiences. But obviously, people get into the program in the final round. And I, you know, my feeling is if you want to do it, go for it. If it doesn't work out, you can figure out what happened, reapply the following fall. You do need a good reason for applying later. I mean, with me, I wanted to prepare academically and retake my GMAT to prove that I could succeed in the program. I did, and I was admitted to most of the schools to which I applied. So so there's those of us who have these success stories from applying in the last rounds, and schools admit them. They wouldn't be offering them if they didn't admit. MIT right. doesn't offer a third round.
Right.
They offer two rounds. So, right. you know, but they have a big wait list. And so so Rod Garcia, another good friend of mine, uses his wait list. And you know, but if they're offering a third round and you want to apply, then go for it.
Yeah, nobody has a third round solely to reject everybody who applies. That's absolutely yeah. true. Now, we're also starting to hear from 2015 applicants mm-hmm. who are wisely getting themselves ready to hit the ground running, no offense to you or Derek, yeah. when the applications come out in the spring and summer. What should 2015 MBA applicants be doing now, in your opinion?
Interesting, because I talked to somebody today who's looking at 2015. So,
right.
So what I usually start with is we start with a strategy. I always start with a strategy, regardless of when somebody is applying. But at this stage in the game, we have a little bit more leisure time to start with a strategy. I ask my clients to come up with a list of must-haves in deal breakers with regard to school. We have a little bit more time to explore their goals, to explore the schools, and so I'll ask them also to, you know, start getting in touch with students and alumni. So really research this probably, you know, much larger list of schools that we're going to eventually narrow down.
Now, when you talk about must-haves, you're not talking about, you're talking about qualities in a given program or.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. The qualities and and the deal breakers, like things that are not important to me or that I absolutely do not want in a school.
Right.
So yes, that is exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I'm going back to the goals again. I feel that this is a great time for people to become experts particularly if they're making a career shift. So you can become an expert in the market of an area that you want to go into. Get to know what's actually going on. So talk to people who are in the field, do informational interviews. That strategy has a twofold purpose. A, you know, it shows your expertise in what you're doing when you apply to schools, but B, you're already getting contacts for your summer internship or for after school. And it makes a lot of sense to start doing some informational interviews. And of course, now is a great time, if they haven't done it already, to study and take the GMAT or GRE, and if the client's a non-native speaker, TOEFL or IELTS. But I think, you know, at this point, it's really about research and some soul searching that makes the process so much easier later on when the essay questions do come out. They can practically write themselves.
And is the soul searching also to assess perhaps weaknesses that you may want to work on to lessen in the next 6 months before you apply?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great time to address deficiencies that a candidate might have in the application. So rather than, I always like people that can be proactive rather than sure. reactive. So one of the things I'll also tell my clients is, you know, if they have a quant weakness, take a class, take MBA math, do things to show that you're being proactive. Don't wait for the school to say, okay, I'm offering you a conditional admission, or I'm putting you on the wait list until you can prove to me that you have the quantitative skills to succeed in my program. Or if they lack community service, I mean, people say, oh, doesn't it look like I'm just starting my community service now for the sake of school? No, if you can make a real impact on your community, then you can start anytime and, you know, do it with passion.
If somebody starts their community service now, today as we're talking, it's February 11th, that means that they would, and they make a commitment, and it's a serious commitment, and as you say, they have impact. But realize that if you apply in September, that means you will have been involved already for 7 months. By the time your application is reviewed, a month or two additionally has gone by. You may be waitlisted, in which case suddenly it's not a couple of months commitment. You're now looking at a year-long commitment. You may really be able to show impact. You know, you don't necessarily know exactly when you're going to apply and get accepted. You could decide to postpone your application to round two, in which case, again, it's a year-long commitment. So I would just say that if you determine lack of community service is a weakness, just do it now.
Right. And I mean, the other thing that I want to, like, the students want to know why they need to do this. Well, you don't want to be a one-trick pony. You don't want to show just all I do is work. You need to show that you have these other interests and that you, I mean, it's a great opportunity. Community service is a great opportunity to display leadership, particularly if you don't have those opportunities at work. You can take on tremendous leadership roles. You know, you're displaying another aspect of yourself that is interesting, that can show leadership, quantifiable impact. So do you have to have volunteer work in your background? No, I mean, there are people that will be accepted without volunteer work.
Sure.
But part of being a good business person is also being a good community citizen. And business schools do look at that. And it shows some variety in your life. And so get started on it now. That's what I would recommend.
Right. Now, we're going to have to bring this to a close. Any last words of advice for MBA applicants out there? Anything we haven't covered that you'd really like them to take away?
So I think, again, during this process, you'll need to go through a lot of introspection. In order to succeed with this, with the application process, you just really, really need to know yourself or get to know yourself during the process. You have a lot of resources that didn't exist when Linda and I were applying to school. So use them. Use them. Use those resources. It's tremendous. It's amazing. We at Accepted offer tremendous insights on our website, through our webinars, and through the consultations. We do one-on-one consultations with people. So definitely contact us for the consultations.
Right. You actually just reminded me, Natalie is going to be giving a webinar on MBA interviews on the 20th, right, Natalie?
I think so, yes.
Yes, okay.
I think that's when.
Yeah, I don't have my calendar in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that's when it is. In any case, we'll be announcing it. It's probably by the time this is posted, it will be online. So, you can sign up for that.
Anyway, I just want to say is that my colleagues and I are happy to help you navigate this maze efficiently and thoroughly, and as I said earlier, with style.
Sounds good. Natalie, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and we've really covered a lot. Round three, interviews, essays, applying round one next year. It's all here in this show. Listener, if you would like to learn more about Natalie and her work, you can find a link to her bio as well as to her clients' comments and feedback in the show notes at info.accepted.com/44. Again, that's info.accepted.com, /44. Thank you, listener. Again, thank you, too, for joining me and Natalie. There are several great resources linked to in today's show notes, so please visit info.accepted.com/44, and you'll find our most recent shows there, related shows, and, again, additional resources that are relevant to today's show. Finally, please share your feedback. 5-star reviews on iTunes are particularly welcome. You can leave any kind of feedback on iTunes, the blog, or by emailing linda@accepted.com. Oh, and if you like the show, subscribe, and you'll get lots and lots more shows just like it, automatically downloaded to however you like to listen to your podcast. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted. I am your host, Linda Abraham, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.